My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be back again this evening. We had a nice meeting last night. I certainly enjoyed the speaker. And another group tonight. We have kind of a polyglot group here. We have people here from Ireland, came in, and Wales, and Australia, all the British Empire's version of terrorists. But I know there's also some people here who have never been to AA before and don't know what it's about, what the big to-do is. And I think just for a moment, just talk about that. There's something that seems quite obvious, although you don't hear it much. There seems to be types of alcoholics. Nobody talks about it much, but there seem to be types of alcoholics. For example, there's a type of alcoholic that seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and they have troubles. They continue to drink. But something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe someone dies, or they lose their family, or they lose an important job. And they're so threatened by it, they quit. And they never drink again. And there's many cases like that. Most of us know people who used to drink badly and have quit. And these same people, if they become addicted to alcohol, which again is something a lot of people don't know about. You know alcohol or drug addiction, that's terrible. What could alcohol addiction be? Let me tell you, the withdrawal from alcohol addiction is about 5 times more lethal than the withdrawal from drug addiction. When you withdraw from drug addiction, you get very sick. When you withdraw from alcohol addiction, you go into convulsions and die as a rule. But these people go to they're the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to be medically withdrawn from alcohol addiction. And each step of the way, they point out the nature of their problem and how they're ruining their lives. And they get out with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit. And they never drink again. Unlike me. In fact, there's a big hospital in Seattle, Washington called Schick Shadel who deals with these kind of alcoholics. And they advertise, "Alcoholics, we will cure your alcoholism in 1 or 10 days with 2 follow-up visits. And it sounds just ridiculous, but they have a long list of names of people who profited from it. I know several of them. And that's the type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and get in trouble, keep drinking, and something happens that really threatens their security, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And the same type of alcoholic come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these are the type of alcoholics that have been a thorn in the side of society for 4,000 written years. Everyone's tried to help them. They've worked for them in many ways. Ancient days, they thought that some of them thought they were possessed by devils and put them to death, burned them. But they, for all these years, they advanced the cutting edge of whatever that society is, has tried to help this type of people, and in vain. They never seem to be able to help them at all. And in fact, in my lifetime, I'm old, but I'm not 4,000 years old. But in my lifetime, when I was born, when I was a young boy growing up, there wasn't any place for people like us to go anywhere. And these are and science and medicine and they all got breakthroughs, nothing ever happens. Most alcoholics have not seen the evidences of this. Where most people like us see the evidence of that type of alcoholic is in the face of someone who loves you. And that terrible look of sadness and say, "Oh my God, how could you? You promised. You were doing better. And the children were starting to feel better. And now you're drunk again. How could you do that?" And I've heard that so many times, and the only answer I ever heard was just, "Leave me alone. Just leave me alone." And people go, "Say, what is wrong with these people?" And these are the type of people that there's no treatment for. And these are the type of people that are mentioned in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He talks about this. He talks about alcoholics of our type. That's the type he's talking about. People who reasonably can be expected that they may get sober, but they will always drink again because of the nature of the mysterious nature of the illness. And it is a strange illness. It took until 1951 before anyone ever classified it American Medical Association finally classified it as a recognizable disease, and there are still doctors who profess it is not, it's just an emotional weakness. And all these years, there's been all sorts of treatments, and one of the things that makes it so baffling, I guess, now, for example, this book was written in 1939, and in the back of the book, you had 12 stories of men who had stayed, the first 12 men who had stayed sober a year with using this philosophy. And later on, most of them died drunk. And you say, why would that be? Were they bad guys? They weren't bad guys. They were good guys. But they, as of yet, had not heard the other end of that illness, which is that it is not like pneumonia. It is not a critical illness where you get terribly sick and then you get better and you're all right. It is more like a severe chronic illness where you're like a diabetic and you get terribly sick and they bring you back and you're all right. But then you have to follow at least a moderate regime. You have to keep taking the insulin. You have to keep getting your mild exercise. You got to get a little sleep. That is the regime for alcoholics. But in the early days of AA, people thought, well, I know I drank terribly, but I'm okay now. And that was the end of it. And they died drunk. So that is one of the things, that's the things we get together for. Sometimes in AA to remember one to another what we're about. And it's the art of staying sober in AA is very simple. It is very simple. It is so simple that it's almost impossible for people to accept. It just seems there must be more to this. And that's why we hear people describing and interpreting what the steps really mean and what the actions really mean. And it's very hard to understand that. And I know that's true because I hate pain. I don't like pain at all. And yet I came to AA and I drank again. It's called me having a slip. And I slipped year after 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 year. I came to AA as kind of a high bottom drunk, moderately high bottom drunk. And years later when I got sober, my last day drinking, two big guys threw me out of a mission in downtown Los Angeles on Skid Row where I knew no one and said, stay out of here, you mooch. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I had written several months before were running that very weekend in Life and Time in the New Yorker, about Borden Cows. And I've had my picture in the New York Times. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of that damn old mission on a cold, rainy October morning. And I stood there and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've seen it in others. But it's a feeling of suddenly look around and realize you've now brought yourself to a point where there is no friendly direction. There's no direction you can go with. Somebody's going to be glad to see you. You really are on your own. And I didn't know what to, I just couldn't imagine. If some old guy would come up to you that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes. You lost all your personal effects. You had them in the car. All your ID and what clothes you had left. Anyway, a guy had you drive a car from Dallas to Los Angeles to get out of Dallas, and you got drunk in Phoenix and lost the car, never found it. All your ID gone, all your clothes gone. You remember that day, because that's the night where you got in beef with the cop and he threw you in jail overnight because you were drunk. In the middle of the night, I was so sick, I went over and threw up. I thought it was a toilet, turned out to be a guy's bunk. He wasn't in it, thank heaven, but I felt better. I lay down next to his bunk and I put my cheeks on the cool tile and went to sleep. And he came back from wherever he was and found this drunken bum on his vomit, his bed full of vomit. He said, you damn drunken alcohol! And kicked my front teeth out. That was one morning that I really was glad I'd spent several thousand dollars in psychoanalysis. I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything to make trouble. I remember that. He said, remember that? That's why you have no teeth. That's why you're standing on the street corner in Skid Row with your dirty clothes, torn, blood, vomit on you. He said, your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you call her and play on her emotions until she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out some more money and send it to her little boy. But she'll use to drink. And he'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. And this guy might have said, you know, you've been going to AA now for almost 10 years, and you sit in these meetings when you're in trouble, and you smirk and think about these idiots, and they're turning out to God and live and let live and first think first, and envy them because they're stupid and you're not. And sit there till the heat's off and leave, and you laugh at AA and joke about these idiots. And now you're dying on the street. And he might have said, why don't you go back to AA at least admit you're an alcoholic and maybe it'll get better. And if someone had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have to say, pal, it isn't the way it looks. I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. My life would be so much simpler if I were an alcoholic, if my life were that simple, but it isn't. I've got a lot of problems. I remember when I was a little boy, I had problems. And I remember thinking, there's something missing in me. I don't know what it is, but I'm pretty good with people at a distance, but when they get close to me, it's almost as though they can see there's something wrong with me, and they don't seem to like me so much anymore. And I don't fit in very well. I don't get along well. I seem to get in trouble. And so when I grow up, it's going to be all different. You know, it's almost as though if you're going through life and your scale inside is supposed to be like this. See, for one reason or another, my scale was always like this for some reason. And when I grew up, I became a rather successful writer. I had a facility for writing. And I made some money. And I went to a psychoanalysis for several thousand dollars to find out the reasons for these feelings. And he had some good reasons. I was raised in a very strict church called the Norwegian Lutheran Church, but I liked it. I didn't know it was strict. Just all I knew. It was like a big cat, you notice that? And he pointed out to me that the Norwegian Lutheran Church had stifled my growth. And I didn't know that, but after he explained it to me, I could see how that had happened. I'd been stifled. I discovered I'd been warped by the Depression. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. But I could see it after he explained it to me. I've been victimized much of my life in ways I never knew. And I used to think, God, no wonder I feel so bad all the time. My life is, I've been an unhappy childhood. It took about almost a year before I realized I'm really getting screwed here because I'm paying this guy and I now understand why I have these emotions, but I still have them. What good is that to? What's the good of knowing why you feel bad if you still feel bad, you know? The only use you might have for it late at night, maybe some big moose, whoever says, what the hell's wrong with you? And you can tell him, I was stifled by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Ah, shut up. And I read books and I did a lot of things. But what saved my bacon, oddly enough, I didn't know it, ever know. When I was a boy, I was raised in this very strict church. And it was a good church. And I was confirmed and catechized and I was taught the facts of life. The church was against two major bad things, sin and Catholics, which seems reasonable at that time. And unfortunately, I grew up to be one and married the other, so ruined me. But I did pretty well. But when I was about 12, my parents got divorced. Now you think, what's the big deal about a divorce? Everybody's had a divorce. If you can imagine what kind of life I had never heard of a divorce at 12 years old. Nobody in my church ever got a divorce. Nobody in our family ever did. And they got a divorce, and they split up, and somebody explained it to me, but I didn't understand it. And I instinctively did the worst thing I could have done. I seem to have a natural flair for screwing up, you know. I've been trained to be good 150 times. I cannot be good. I never had any training in being rotten, and I just do that wonderfully. But I began playing my mother against my father to avoid the structure of my life. And, I'd go to my mother, and if she was mad and mean to me, I'd run to my father. And if he was mean to me, I'd run to my mother. If they both mean to me, I'd run to my grandma. And I outsmarted them again and again and again and again and fooled them. By the time I was 15, I was in terrible shape. I was flunking out of school. I didn't like anybody, didn't like anything. And I really felt bad all the time. I didn't know what it was. I had gotten rid of the structure of my life, I guess. And I think something bad would happen to me. Because I was really on a bad streak. And what saved me, the war started. Our version of the war in December of 1941. And I got caught up in that and watching movies, doing things. And one day I was having some problems, about to flunk out of high school as a junior. And I thought, if I could go to the Pacific and be a Marine and kill Japs, I'll be a hero, I'll be something. I told my mother, I want to go up to see my aunt in Superior, Wisconsin. She packed my little bag and gave me a bus fare. And I took, guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis, 100 miles away. And I decided to hitchhike to San Francisco. 1,800 miles away. I didn't know how far it was. I looked in the school library, it's a page and a half, didn't see that. But I never hitchhiked. I was a dumb kid. I stood outside of Minneapolis where they told me to stand, and I stopped, and the guy said, where are you going, kid? I said, I'm going to San Francisco. He said, so am I, hop in. And away we went. And it turned out he was in the Navy going back to his ship, but I don't know why he picked me up. All the way across the country, we'd stop at that. There were no motels. They'd stop in trailer courts, and he'd buy my meals, and get me a bed, and listen to my prattle all day long. I just must have been a saint. And I said, I want to go there to kill Japs. He said, well, you're a young kid. You're only this tall, and your face full of pimples. He said, I think you're not going to get in the Marine Corps. You're 15. He said, maybe get in the Merchant Marine, because they're really crying. A lot of other good guys are on the Navy. Maybe get in the Merchant Marine. I said, okay. And he showed me where to go in San Francisco. Coast Guard office down there. I'll be in the Merchant Marine. I said, all right, fill out this application. And he told me to put down 16s. Okay. So you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. Got it back. They gave me Seaman's papers. They took another guy and I down to the National Maritime Union. We signed some waiver for dues, whatever the hell they were. Took us to a big ship, and we put us on that ship. And that afternoon, we're on a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. No training, no nothing, just dumb. And it really was fun for about an hour. And it just kind of peeled off after that. But on that ship, they put me in a room with three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, dumb Norwegian Lutheran little puke could be with. And these people are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be? I could see there's a little tension, so I told them a joke that I used to go over good in the study hall. It didn't go over good there. The guy said, why'd you get that bunk up there and shut up? I still remember that bunk. The ship was moving around like this, and it was hot, and these guys start talking. And I thought, I'm in a room with sinners. I mean, big-time sinners. I thought I'd sinned a little bit because I swore once or twice and didn't always go to church. These people were big-time sinners. I mean, they'd been in San Francisco for about 3 days, and they'd been doing terrible things with girls. And I couldn't believe it. I don't want to give the wrong impression. At the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it. I couldn't believe they were doing it with people. Ugh. And I remember looking at them thinking, of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. And after 2 or 3 days, I became the ship fool. I got a role that I filled very well. You know, hey, kid, get on the engine room, tell me you need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge, tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And they would sit and drink whiskey after the watch. They weren't supposed to have any whiskey in the ship. Who's those? These guys were pirates, I mean. And I just sit there shocked and turn my face to the wall and want my mother. And one day one of these guys turned to me and says, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for those snort? And that was too much, because whatever I am, I'm a Lutheran. And I determined just to really destroy this guy, I was going to say, you get that bottle out of my face. I guess you don't know this, but I happen to be a Norwegian Lutheran. And we don't drink whiskey. And I promised my mother and grandmother I would never drink whiskey, and I wouldn't talk about things the way you talk about them, and I wouldn't do the things you do, and I'll thank you not to ever put that whiskey around me again. I was just going to tell him that. I said, well, you think you're man enough? I heard a voice say, God damn right. So I had my first drink out of the first bottle I was ever close to. It burned my mouth and my throat and my stomach and my throat and my mouth and his shirt finally.
Get the bottle away from him, son of a bitch.
To this day, the worst emotion I know in life is public humiliation, where someone just makes you look like a fool and there's nothing you can do about it. I want to hit these guys, they laugh at me. I didn't dare do anything. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. It'd have thrown me overboard, but it would have been cute. I could lean over you. Yeah. Take that. Just give him the old arm. But all the way across the Central Pacific, when nobody was with that, I'd take a drink of whiskey out of one of these guys' bottles, and I hated it, and I'd throw it up, and I'd have to wipe it up. But I had a fixation. If I could drink it and I didn't throw up, they'd think I was a man, which was ridiculous. Nothing would think I was a man. But I remember just coming into Pearl Harbor, and they're digging up ships, and it was the night before my 16th birthday, and I'm down there drinking that crap and stayed down. Then I couldn't breathe. And all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. And I didn't know what had happened. In retrospect, I would say what happened was that it was the first time I ever felt the way men looked. And I would say that the scale behind me went away, at least for the period of drinking. And I loved it. And the next day they took me into Honolulu and got me 3 bottles of beer and I got drunk and they thought it was cute and I thought it was cute. And I didn't get in trouble with a drinker at all. I discovered when you're in your teens, you learn things. You know. Everybody in that ship smoked. Nobody in my family smoked. They all smoked. So I learned to smoke. I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. One day I smoked and didn't puke and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 47 years. Until I realized it was making me bald. And I learned to talk dirty a little bit. I felt kind of like a man. And they got another ship going to the Aleutian Islands. We were trying to get the Japanese out of the Aleutian Islands. And when I was old enough, I went to the Navy. When I was 17, at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital up in Northern California being sewed together. And they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests because I read. And they gave me a high school diploma. I'm still a failing junior, but now I've got a high school diploma. Went back to Wisconsin after the war, went to the university there, won some trophies for the university. Got married. I met this girl in college. She had black, shiny hair and black, flashy eyes. I'd never seen anything like that. So pretty. And she won my heart. And then she dropped the big one. She said, "I'm a Catholic." I thought, okay, what did I do with her? I can't take her home. But she won my heart. We got married. And out in the world, I became a sports writer for newspapers. And then my wife began manifesting the terrible behavior pattern of Catholics that I didn't know about and no Protestant boy ever knows about, but I found out. My wife began having children at a rapid clip, and I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just boom. I remember saying, "You can't use birth control." No. I think about that sometimes. It's hard to believe in this day and age of freedom, but in those days, you know, I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes, really, because I'd been in the Navy, I'd been overseas, I'd been through a major university, and I heard the word condom once in my life, maybe, in a Navy training film, where they showed this voluptuous girl that explained what would happen to you if you didn't use a condom. At that age, I didn't care what happened to me if I could just have her. I'll go out with a bang. But they'd have kids. Kind of borderline bad kids who say things like, "I got a rubber." And even they'd be ashamed to buy them. They'd have to hire someone depraved to go in. And even they'd be ashamed to go and say, "Give me a pack of cigarettes and some rubbers." Now look how much progress we've made in the last 50-some years. The drugstore where my house in Los Angeles, kids come in and say things like, "Hey! Give me a package of condoms and some cigarettes." But I tried to get better jobs, and I had to get advertising and public relations. I worked in big companies, and all the years I drank and raised hell and had fun. I always could blame World War II for everything that went on. And the best friend I ever had was alcohol, because no matter when I felt bad, alcohol made bad things good and good things better. I loved alcohol. You know, it's terrible if you're new to hear someone say, my best friend was alcohol. But I'll tell you, friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. But when a few drinks is the only thing that makes you feel like you're something, and you can get it anywhere, it's a great thing. And the only problem I ever had, I have a tendency to drink a little too much. And I have been known to act bizarrely. And so when I was still a young man, my friends were saying, you know, you're getting in trouble and getting arrested once in a while. Why don't you go to this new thing in town called Alcoholics Anonymous? I don't know what they do there, but even the town drunks are cutting down. So I went in there. Sure. I was 22. I had one room with eight fat guys sitting around a table. What are you supposed to read? I thought, geez, I'm back on that ship again. What is this? I said, well, my friend said I might come up here and be helped. You think you're an alcoholic? No. What the hell do you think's wrong with you? I think I'm too sensitive. Listen to this, Earl. He's too sensitive. I realized later the reason I took that attitude was that there was nobody in that state within 20 years of me in AA. It was an older guy's disease at that time. But I hung around there for a while. It didn't take me long. If you're new tonight, if you'd want to know about AA, I learned it in a week. You know, what is AA? AA is a place where alcoholics go. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who drinks too much alcohol and gets in trouble. And he comes to AA and admits his problem is alcohol, and then he returns to God, and then he shows his gratitude by helping others, and it's just wonderful. And it's just so dreary to even think about that kind of crap. And I went to AA for a little while, but that's not me. My problem is not alcohol. I don't think I want to return to God. I'm not good terms with him by this time. And I certainly don't have time to help some other puke. And so I left, and I went to a different city, and I got a job in a big corporation. And I wrote pretty well, but I began drinking heavily, and they called me in, as they always do, to the personnel office. You know, Emerson, we think you're doing a good job, but you're drinking a little too much. You have to do something about it. And I had a great idea that just changed my life. I don't know where it came from. I said, I know, Mr. Carlson, I do seem to have a drinking problem. But they got this new program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've always wanted to go there to help me with my drinking. Would you work with me a few weeks while I go to AA? Yes, that's a good idea. I wouldn't have thought of that. And you go to AA, at least takes the heat off of work, and at least you can look for a job. And you can go home and say to your wife, well, dear, I've gone back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Wonderful. Wonderful. What do they want you to do, honey? They want me to take her off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody, anywhere. No, they don't want you to taper off. They want you to stop entirely. We have the same stuff you do. We have a program. I release you, you son of a bitch. But I did this, and I went to a different company. Drank until I got in trouble. They let me go to AA. And I did this again and again. And I'd get up and go down for a while and come back up. I did this for years. Went to AA several times, a couple times a year for 2-3 weeks, and barely could sit through that crap, but it's something, you know. And went down finally in Texas and didn't come back up. I couldn't believe it. I'd been working at a big corporation called Tracy Rock, and I'd been working on the LC Delmarez, which are big ads for the board and company. And I cost them an account because I screwed up badly in my drinking, and they fired me, and they told my wife in advance, so she left town with the kids. They took my car back, and I went from being a big shot on Monday and Friday, I was standing in the street corner holding my bags, and I knew how to get out of Texas because I was kind of on probation from the state nut house. And I got a guy to give me his car to drive to Los Angeles for me. Got to El Paso, got drunk, and went to Phoenix, got drunk, and lost the car. And here I am in Phoenix now, coming out of jail at 7 o'clock in the morning, my mouth bleeding. I don't know a soul. Where can you go when you look that bad? There's only one place. Go to an AA club. Those dummies, the worse you look, the more they like it. Here's this one, Earl. He's mine. And you go over there and pretend to be an alcoholic for a while and listen to their crap. I hustled some money for $20, and I got a bus fare out of there, and I got to Los Angeles, and There was a guy there that I'd give him a start, and he'd now a big start. He gave me a bunch of money. I drank that up and had a good time, and then I lost it. Called him for more, and he said, no, I called Dallas, and he said, you're a bum. I thought you had a car accident. You have a car accident. You're a bum. And 3 days later, two guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission. And there I stood, and I can only tell you how I wished my problem was alcohol, but it isn't. What's alcohol? Alcohol's got people. What do you know about alcohol? Well, there are people, when they just start drinking, they can't stop. I can stop anytime. I've stopped so many times. My problem is not that I can't stop. My problem is once I stop, it seems like the next day or a couple of days later, a few days later, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It comes out as this little growing restlessness. A little irritability. Just a little tired of the damn sermons all the time and reminding me what I've done. And the job gets a little dreary and my children get big, noisy and my wife nags me and I'm in a black and white world. And in that glass there's some technicolor. And eventually I drink it. But I don't drink it because I'm a drinker. I drink it because I'm a feeler. Nobody seems to understand that. When I drink, and it changes. And sometimes I drink too much. And people say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? You have to say, yeah, I guess it was. I just want to scream, no, it wasn't alcohol. You don't understand, it wasn't. If people get off my back, I'd be all right. Let me have a little fun, for Christ's sake. And that's the way it was. I stood in that street corner, and I knew I was dying. And I knew I was not an alcoholic. And I knew I couldn't return to God, because by this time, I'd broken all 10 commandments. And there was no way back for Lutherans after you've broken 10 commandments. And I thought, I'm going to die in the street. I thought, some guy said, well, nobody came up and talked to me. I just stopped and said, what? Where's the AA club? I'll go there and get out of the rain anyway. He said, well, it's corner Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell is that? He said, well, doesn't Wilshire did one way down here. You have to go up this hill to Hill Street and cut over Wilshire and work once until you get to Fairfax. All right. Some years later, I counted my car. That was about 7.5 miles. That's a long walk when you're sick and you can barely walk and your mouth is bleeding and you feel terrible. And there's just nobody. I'm sure there are people in this room that understand that philosophy, though. When you're on your own and you burn them all off, you just do what you got to do. There's nobody even to complain to. You better do it or you die very early. And I got to this stupid club and the same old thing. Oh, here, you're home, son. Ha, 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 ha. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate that. And I hung around that club that night and there was a meeting and they served cake. I had about 4 pounds of cake. I could chew that. They had a meeting on gratitude and I almost puked it up again. Guy said, you can sleep in that abandoned car out there in the parking lot. Oh, Jesus, thanks a lot. I slept in that and still remember vaguely doing that. My mouth bleed. I thought, how could this be happening to me? I'm brilliant and I have a great ability that I just think, I know I do. And I'm a bum on the streets. They're just sickening to everybody. And the next day I went to the club and it was Sunday morning. I ate some more cake and they had a meeting, talked about God or somebody that I couldn't bear to listen to. And I hung around there day after day for several days. And just kept raining. I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what hell is. Maybe hell isn't fire and brimstone at all. Maybe it's just feeling sick and your mouth bleeding on your shirt. And everywhere you go, people behind you, you can hear laughing and ridiculing you. And there's no place to turn. And nobody seems to care about you. And that scale is like this. And maybe that's what hell is. And I had no idea that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be, had no desire for it to be, because to me, sobriety is an endless pain. It's interesting, the third traditional there says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I had no desire to stop. I had a desire to get out of that town and get someplace where it'd be better, and I never could find it. And the manager of the club, he said, you know, kid, to be in here during the daytime, this buffer must be a member, but you're such a mess, I'll let you come in here while it keeps raining. But don't ask anybody for money and don't be a smart aleck. And you got to go to a meeting every night. Oh, Jesus. sits with these idiots. People say this. Remember a guy saying,
I stayed drunk for 20 years, night and day. One day I went through that door. They told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy.
But what saved me is in those meetings, I saw a guy that I'd seen in the movies. Isn't that silly? I thought he was a movie star. He wasn't. He'd only been in three movies, and I saw him in two of them. I found out later. But at the time, he was a movie star. And what does a movie star say to you? Famous with a lot of money. I thought, I'll bet he would like a new friend. And I kind of warmed up to him. He didn't like me. And then started on me again. At the end of the week, we said, get a sponsor. Get ready to get a sponsor. That's the way it is with those activist groups. They're always on you about something. So I thought, I'll get this actor to be my sponsor. I bought. I'm a newcomer. Would you like to be my sponsor? He said, sure, kid. Now, what should I tell you? Oh, sure, Bob. And they said he wasn't a very good actor, but he really was, because he acted nice in meetings. And that took a lot of acting for him, because he turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort.
Do this, do this.
I'm like, why would I take this crap from this guy? Because he is my only meal ticket other. I had a plan. Now, if you want to hear a motive to stay sober, my plan was, I wanted to stay sober and get some money from this idiot and get some teeth and get some clothes and go back to New York, a big agency, say, yes, I did drink and I was screwing up a lot for a lot of years, but I'm okay now, I'm straight, my eyes are clear, I'm prepared. I said, but you said that to so many people, we can't trust you. I'll work for nothing until you can trust me. And I'll work for a while and I'll do my best. Pretty soon I'll make some big money and I'll put it in my pocket and I'll come back to Los Angeles and I'll buy the AA club and I'll burn it down. And I'm going to wait till they have an all groups meeting in there so I can hear them scream as they come running. Is that a motive to stay sober or what? And I found out later this guy didn't like me. And I don't blame him. Because I don't want to brag, but I was the worst type of newcomer there ever is in AA. And I know they're the worst because I've sponsored a couple of them. And they're the kind of people, they just walk in a room and say, hi, and you just wish you had a rifle. Here's hi. I'll tell you what type of person. It's a person who's been around AA year after year, drinks and comes back, and drinks and comes back, and knows all about AA and keeps drinking, and every time they come back, they want more attention. But I knew Bob would tell me things. I said, I know that, Bob. He gave me a long discussion about a quotation in the book. I said, Bob, you misquoted the book. Yeah, that makes people crazy, kind of. But he tried to help me, and he'd take me to meetings, and he'd talk to me sometimes. But I knew the problems of, you know, I knew alcohol, your problems, alcohol, and all this crap you go through. And that's not me. Sometimes when I'm drunk, my problem is alcohol. But you don't understand, when I'm not drunk, it's bad. And I don't want to be sober. I'd been sober once in my life. Really sober. And that was when I was going through a spell where I was drinking heavy. And I go to jail. In that period, I went to jail every so often, overnight. No big crimes, but when I get to a certain point in my drinking, I have to counsel police officers and point out their errors and tell them they're wrong. And I get thrown in jail overnight, get up in the morning, go to work. And this one morning I got out of jail and a guy was there that I knew. He said, oh God, you should have stayed home last night. Your little son died. We couldn't find you. You were out drunk somewhere. And I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy that just about killed me. And I swore that would never happen again. I put my hand in his casket. I said, John, this will never happen again, old boy. And a few years later, when I was drinking a little bit more and had a bunch of kids, and I realized that I started to drink too much again, and I stopped drinking. I stopped for my dead son, John. And I really felt good about it. And for the first time in a long time, my daughters and I would do things together, four little girls, and I was going to work and doing a good job, and I was not drinking, wasn't sick all the time. I really felt wonderful. I thought, I should have done this a long time ago. And then one day somebody snuck into my bedroom in the middle of the night, put an invisible spring in my gut. And now we started again. And now I had a new thing. This stinking God killed wanted my little boy, who never committed a sin in his life, to punish me because I'm bad. What kind of a stinking God would do that? Screw you! And it got worse and worse and worse. And my job was getting mad. My daughters, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For Christ's sake, I'll be alone. I'm sorry, we'll play to just hate myself and be alone. And mounting tension. And I knew, if I could just get two or three drinks, I'd be all right. But when you promised your dead son you're not going to drink, you're not going to drink. And one day, my wife took the children to Mass. And I just pulled the car in the garage, trucked up a hose in the back seat, and turned the morning, went to sleep, and died. And the guy next door happened to be looking out of the window having a cup of coffee and saw me go in there and heard the motor running and I didn't come out, so he walked over there and found me dead in the car and they pulled me out and they beat in my chest and breathed in my mouth. They rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and examined me, determined I was seriously mentally ill and put me into the state insane asylum. Now that's how I get when I get sober. That isn't what something I'm looking for, I'll tell you. I've often thought about that. I hadn't had a drink for some time by that time, so they didn't put no alcohol in my commitment papers. It said, schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies. I'd like to go back there sometime and find that psychiatrist. He's probably about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good. Describing me as a schizophrenic, a dual personality, you idiot! You should lose your license. If I could have got my personality down to two, I'd have been all right. My problem has always been this whole group that gets together in my head every so often. Let's get out of here. I don't think we can. What do you think? I don't know. Look around the room. I used to hear people today say things. I don't think your program's enough for me. I may need group therapy. I never did. Just go for a ride alone in my car. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what's so good about alcohol. Alcohol makes it one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. Why don't you quit your job and punch your boss in the face? It's a great feeling. But that's how I get when I get sober. It took me a long time to get out of that. But, you know, I was in the Texas Insane Asylum, which is Big Spring, Texas, and I was there. And I thought, these people are really dumb here. I should be able to beat them. And it took me about 3 weeks and I escaped. And I ran away. And I don't know if you've ever been in Texas, but all of a sudden I realized they can see you running for 3 days out there. You know. It's just a matter of time when somebody's field glasses pick you up. Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they brought me back and gave me a bunch of shock treatments, and I didn't get out of there until next year. That's how I get when I get sober. Now, why would I get sober this time? It started the worst way. I was at this meeting with my brother, with my sponsor. I heard him say something. I don't know if he said it to somebody else who said it to me, but he said something stupid. He said, you know, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. What the hell is this? What are you talking about, Bob? Everybody knows that's what alcohol. He said, the problem is not alcohol. Oh, come on. I said, I've been to hundreds of meetings over the last 10 years. It is alcohol. What is it? What do you think? Is this some Screen Actors Guild breakthrough? He said, kid, the problem here is not alcohol. There's a way to beat an alcohol problem. You stop drinking and clean up your act. I said, that's stupid, Bob. I've done that 100 times. That doesn't work. He said, that's right. That's because apparently your problem isn't alcohol. You must have the same problem I got. That looks like alcohol, but it isn't. And what is it, Bob? Is it something called alcoholism? I said, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I'm look terrible and I'm smarter than hell. Alcohol, alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. He said, listen, and he gave me a long talk, probably over a period off and on a couple of days. I tried not to listen to none of it because you don't want to hear that kind of crap. But some of it stuck in my head, and I'm glad it did. Is anybody here having trouble with staying sober? I hope you listen to what I just got to say, because this much of it began the process for me. He said, kid, I told you, if your problem is alcohol, and I guess he's talking about that type of alcoholic, you stop drinking and you clean up your act, and you look pretty good after that. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, nobody ever said that to me before. Well, he said, that's what alcoholism. I said, if that's the case, then why do these people drink alcohol, these alcoholics, if it's doing, when they know it's going to do bad things to them? He said, kid, they're not doing it because they're going to do bad things to them. He said, you've been around AA so long, you tell me? Alcoholics, they say, have an unnatural reaction to alcohol. You know what that reaction is? I said, of course I do, Bob. It's that type of craving and you can't stop. And the phenomenon, he said, nah, stop it. That's podium talk. The phenomenon that makes an alcoholic is this, kid. Alcohol has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. He took a glass of water. When I have a few drinks, it almost instantly changes the way things look. And inside I become taller and straighter, and they become less threatening and frightening to me. I said, Jesus, Mom, what's wrong with that? He said, because it isn't really happening, you idiot. It's in your head. He said, and then sometimes it sets up this phenomenon of craving. Nobody understands that. Nobody's ever explained that. And they never have. Nobody's ever explained this phenomenon of craving. I have a theory of what I've been able to see in my life and other lives. But for people like me, when things are really bad, you're sick of black and white, and things are going to hell, and you eat a few drinks, and you take a few drinks, and things get better, you start to sag, and you instantly have another drink to hold it. And you drink, keep drinking. In fact, you can see guys so drunk they can't even walk. Hey, give me another drink. If, what do you want to drink? They don't want to drink. They're trying to hold it. But eventually you can't. You get so drunk, you get sober, you get always. Okay, Bob, I understand that. Okay, now that people are sober again, and now they know that alcohol is bad, why would they drink it now? He said, that's the other part of the whole problem, the other part of alcoholism, kid. It isn't alcohol. He said, when people are born and they grow up, you get through a lot of things. You have to learn how to solve problems that are facing you, learn to face conflicts, learn to get along with people, learn what not to do, learn what to do, live in the world with some degree of comfort, find solutions to problems when you have emotional problems, find ways to avoid them or to solve them. He said the whole process is called maturing. And if you become a mature individual, you will live rather comfortably. You get along, you can hold jobs, you get along with your kids, you get along with your family, you get along with the neighbors. Everybody likes you. He said, this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because of people like us, we don't stick around to find the solutions to problems many times. We just drink and get rid of them. Here's to you, beneficial finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Collins, take your job and shove it up your nose. And it's great. Except without being aware of it, I'm building a whole closet of very childish emotional reactions, conditioned reflexes, as it were. And so that one day the day comes, I say, boy, I'm sick of being in a jam. I'm sick of trouble. I'm going to stop drinking. I'm going to go on the wagon. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm going to go to work every day. I'm going to get along with my kids. I'm going to do fine. I'm going to have this potential, everybody says this. I'm going to make it realized. I'm going to eat them up. And never have the slightest idea that it's absolutely impossible. Because sooner or later, someone will trigger my emotions and I'll start having my childish reactions. You hurt my feelings, I'll get you, you son of a bitch. I'll quit. You did this to me. Little by little, emotions charge. And they mount and they mount and they mount. And one day, you say the three words that kill people like me, and I propose like you. It isn't, I need booze. It doesn't give me more. Just, what's the use? What's the use, for Christ's sake? I tried everything I know how. These people just won't let up. And I drink, and it's gone. I drink till I get sober, and I stay sober till I have to drink. I drink till I have to stay sober. I stay sober till I have to drink. And every time I go back and forth, my head says, see, it wasn't the alcohol and all. It's them. You're not being treated right. They don't understand you. You're kind of sensitive, and you're vulnerable. And you try to pretend you're not, but you are, and you feel different. They don't understand that. No wonder you drink. That's why people like us die. I said, my God, Bob, that's the story of my life. For the last 10, 12 years, I had so many chances to be something on top, and here I am still sleeping in an abandoned car just because of that. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh, because he swore a lot. What is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, seriously? Is that real? He says, an alcoholic is a person who has trouble drinking. And sobriety is so bad they got to drink. I said, my God, I'm an alcoholic. I never would have guessed that in 10 years sitting in AA meetings. That was in December of 1958, a long time ago. And since then, I never had a drink or a pill or a medication or anything. And you think, oh, his life turned out wonderfully. No, it didn't. My early years were terrible because I still had a smart mouth and a bad brain, and I got fired off jobs, and Bill Bob was mean to me. It was just terrible. But I knew that if I start drinking again, I'll never get sober again. So I know when it gets to this point, I have to drink, but I'm not going to. But I'll put this up here. If it gets here, I'll give myself permission to commit suicide, but I won't drink. And a lot of times I got bad enough to drink, but not quite bad enough to commit suicide. And I'll tell you something happened. I began doing something that a guy like me never does. In my desperation, I would confess to him how weak I was. And that's something weak people don't want to do. Strong people don't mind talking about their weaknesses. But weak people, that's all you got. They know what a weak thing you are. Nobody's going to like you. You know that. And he would listen to me and apparently understand me and tell me something to do that would make it better. And somehow there, without even being aware, but I thought about this recently, I was talking to somebody. I began to get just a feeling, my God, this guy knows how I feel. You think, what's the big deal about that? I had never known anybody that I believed knew how I felt. My dad didn't, my doctor didn't, my psychiatrist didn't, nobody, my bosses, they all say, we know how you feel. And you have to say, thank you. But what you want to say is, get your damn hands off me. You don't know how I feel at all. And then what's so important about finding somebody who knows how you feel? And it's just this. There isn't a drinker in this crowd, maybe even not a not drinker, who hasn't had enough advice to last them for 5,000 years. People give us advice at the drop of a hat. What people walking by, here's what I think you ought to do. Advice. And after a while, you just learn to shine it off. You say, thank you very much. And just shine it off. But if it's somebody that you believe knows how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information. And you may do things you would never do for anybody else. I remember standing at the Brentwood meeting, having a cup of coffee, just about 6 blocks from where some years later, O.J. Simpson didn't kill his wife. I was standing there, and my sponsor said, see that woman over there? Yes, I see her. I don't like her. I want you to apologize to her. Why should I apologize to her? Someone told me that the Monday night you called her a bitch. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. Anybody else in the world who told me that, I'd have said, to hell with you! You apologize! If you want to embarrass yourself, I'm not going to embarrass myself with that old bag. You go over there. Not me! But it was somebody that knew how I felt, I believed. And I thought to myself, oh, God. Sorry. You bitch. I understand you're going to quit your job. Bob, they got me stuffing envelopes for $1.09 an hour. I used to have an office bigger than this company. They treat me like a piece of crap, huh? says, you stay on that job till you get a better job. Anybody else says, no, I'm not. I'm getting out of here. But and go to all these things. And little by little, my life began to change. I eventually held a job for 3 months. I said, God, what a break. By the time I was 2 years sober, I had a few little jobs where I'd made enough money to have a little one-room apartment in Hollywood. And I felt pretty good, still didn't have any front teeth. The guy gave me a job as a beginning writer in a medical corporation. I'd been a successful writer, now as a beginning writer, none of this. Still had no front teeth. So I had to go to work and carry my lips like this. A lot of people thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I went to work every day, and my sponsor insisted I go to work every day. I said, Jesus, Bob, I'm in one of my moods today. Ah, shut up, go to work. And I almost didn't. The first week I was there, I almost left. Some guy said something that really hurt my feelings, but my clothes weren't very good. And I was ready to pop him and get out of there. But I'd promised Bob I'd call him. Bob, this is what this guy said to me in front of the man. Shut up, he explained. Here's what you're doing. I said, that didn't work on this creep. He said, try it. And I tried it, and it worked. It cooled off. I did that many times in the next few months. Because I had just raw emotions. I had a good intellect, but I was, you know, they talk about alcoholic emotions. You know the name for them? Childish emotions. We like to think of them as, oh, just I've got alcoholic emotions. What are childish emotions? They're alcoholic emotions. I hate you. I love you. You hurt my feelings. I'm going to run away. Let's get married. You know. And little by little, he cut me through. By the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that corporation. He had front teeth, nice clothes. If anybody here lost some teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually perfect, they grow back. I forget exactly how it happened. I was 7 years sober. The other guy and I were brought to Hollywood, and we created the number one hard rock railroads radio station in America. I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations, oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. Slick. Hey, baby. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet. All the way to Dallas, Texas. Jumped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody gave me a book on the rhythm system, ended all that. But all my kids have grown up now. Three of my daughters turned 17 this year in AA. And the other kids, the last child was a son, so I had another son. And I believe he's an alcoholic. His wife has left him, and he's got a good job, but he doesn't often go to it. And but he's not. He was raised inside of a hot box of AA, and he just said, I'm not an alcoholic. Okay. All of my children have turned out well, except my oldest daughter. You hate to talk about things like this, because you want to give people hope. But my oldest daughter has become a judge. We so wanted a defense attorney, but no. She comes home at Christmas, she says things like, Daddy, remember your little girls used to send us to our room? I said, sure, honey. She said, when you come to Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm going to send you to a little room. It's all very nice. I want to just quickly talk about something else if you're new tonight. This, the old timers all know this. Because after I was sober about 2 weeks, and knew I was an alcoholic, at least I didn't know the problem was, then they come on with this other stuff. They say, time to start working the steps. I said, Bob, the first three steps would keep me out of AA. They don't apply to me. I can't return to God. I can't turn my life over to God. None of that crap works. I'm not insane. And Bob, I can't return to God. I just can't. I can't return to God. You know, I know you want me to, but I can't. He said, nothing in AA asks you to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself. Does that fool the other boys and girls? You and I knew what the hell we're talking about. Don't kid me. He says, it doesn't say that. Why don't you read the damn thing? Never ask you to return to anything in AA. Because you're coming out of sickness and you shouldn't go back into sickness. It says you come to believe in something. Can't you believe in God? I said, no, I can't, Bob. If God exists, I am damned, and I'm not going to live with that. He says, can't you believe in AA? I said, well, I like it better than I used to, but not a hell of a lot. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? And of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that. He couldn't send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. People around the club would say, there's that crazy bastard who thinks his sponsor's God. But I tried to do what he said. But the thing in that step that really is a little throws you off, it says, come to believe some part of myself will do what? Restore me to sanity. Now think about that a bit. What is sanity? Have you ever heard anybody describe sanity? You can read 10 textbooks on mental health and you get 10 differing definitions of sanity. But oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. And it's just like this. But the human brain, this oversimplifies, but it's basically true. Human brain is under sufficient conflict and pressure and can find no way to release the pressure and conflict and a desperation in order to maintain what's called its neural integrity. In desperation, it will make parts of reality look different than they are. That is called psychosis. Some people, it's all the whole thing, they're put away. But most people just rifle about. You see an example, for example, and read the paper about a guy said, I've been living enough to destroy this man for 10 years. Nice guy. But he came home last night and took a rifle and shot his kids and shot his wife and killed himself. Nobody knows why he did it. Something triggered that psychosis in that guy. But that's what psychosis is. But you don't even know you're seeing it. The good part about that is alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that nice? They say they do. They say, oh, I was psychotic last year, now I'm not. You don't go in and out of psychosis. When you're psychotic, you stay psychotic. In very, very, very rare instances. But you may hear this phrase, well, they say in AA that alcoholism is the second greatest cause of insanity. And that's right, it is. But not in psychosis. In something else. Anybody who's a drunk in this crowd, I'm sure, knows how it feels to wake up in the morning sometimes and have something, need something wet and cold to put the fire out. Oh, Jesus. Why is that? You've just been drinking, you've been drunk. Because alcohol, the only substance I've ever heard of, the only fluid that dries out your body, it dries and it dries out the cells. It's called desiccates the cells, kills cells all over your body. And when you come up, you're really dried up. And you add fluids and they come alive again. And when you get drunk again, they die again. And you add fluids, they come alive again. This goes on and on and on and on. So far, so good. But there are two organs in the body that when the cells die, they do not come alive again. One is your liver, one is your brain. And that's where people like us have trouble in those areas. It takes a lot of drinking, a long time, because there's millions of cells there. But eventually you can dry out enough cells in your brain so you can't function. That is, oddly enough, what we call a wet brain. It's a dried out brain. And a wet brain people, you know, they're really bad. And you think, well, maybe I got it. Not at all. Most of you will never see a case of, I see them a lot. I wish I didn't. People with what's called the Korsakoff syndrome sit in a ward somewhere in a chair on a bed, and people come and feed them and change their diapers and put them to bed and get them up and feed them and change their diapers and put them to bed. And it's very much like the last stages of Alzheimer's, except Alzheimer's has the niceness to kill the patient. Alcoholic insanity, you could sit like that for 50 years if your body's healthy. Your family comes down from time to time to see if Dad or Mom knows him. You know us? Here we are, Mom. Get away from me. Who the hell are you? Get out of my room. And they cry and go home. Alcoholic insanity is a terrible, terrible thing. Yeah. But why don't alcoholics become psychotic, do you think? Because of something I never dreamed about, and I remember talking to some doctors about this year, a few years ago, but so after, I don't know, I never thought of it. When it gets bad enough, long enough, I drink alcohol. And that has the power to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. You and I are able to induce temporary psychosis. And it doesn't go away until you drink, until you get sober again. In fact, some scientists say that people like us can get to a point of such desperation that you must drink to preserve your sanity. And then to drink puts you a step closer to insanity. So with the second step, I think it really means what it says. I have to come to believe there's some power here. I don't really have to know how it's going to happen. You don't have to guess how it's going to happen. You have no way of knowing it because it comes way down the road. You just have to believe it can happen. It can restore you to living in a world where you don't ever have to drink to stand it. You think, but how can that be? Never mind how it can be. The fact that these rooms are full of people for whom it has happened and they're just like you indicates it can happen if you do the right thing. That's all the second step means. These steps mean what they say. The hell with interpretations. You have to admit you're having problems with alcohol. You have to admit you're having problems without alcohol. Then you have to come to believe there's a power here that will, something that will make it not necessary for you to drink. But then that third and last step, that always was scary to me, because that puts it right on the table. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. And I thought, I can't do that. And I made this decision. I'm going to try this. I'm going to make that step read. I'm going to do everything I can to do what my sponsor says. Which sounds sacrilegious, doesn't it? But I look back now, and that's exactly what the step talked about. Turning my will and my life to the best of my ability. And I wasn't a perfect guy at all. I was very error-prone, very mistaken, very emotional. But I tried to do it. And as a result of that, sometime later, one day I was almost on the edge of suicide, my sponsor made me write an inventory. I swore I'd never write. I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why don't I take it with an out-of-work actor, for God's sake? But I wrote down things in there that I never would have told my psychiatrist. And you say, why don't you tell your psychiatrist? Because you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why I don't tell the psychiatrist. I'd want some little wimp to say to me, you did what, sir? Get out of my office. But wash off that chair first, will you? You know. And he took me for a ride along the ocean, had me read it to him. And I thought, God, we got 40 miles from Los Angeles and I'm still reading. I thought, when he hears this, he's going to make me get out and walk and never talk to me again. I said, I'm all done now, Bob. He says, you finished with that inventory? He says, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober. You got a chance. And I said, thought it was. And he had me make amends to my father, the man I hadn't talked to in 10 years because I hated him because I thought he deserved my mother. A lot of things that made amends to people that hated, flew across the country and apologized to the company. Terrible. But little by little, it began to change my perception of life. And these steps eventually changed my life. Because you know, if you're new, I'll tell you something the steps are about. You would think that staying sober is the purpose of AA. Not really. I mean, it's necessary, but it's not the goal. I've been sober. If being dry was the goal of AA, I've been sober 47 and a half years. I should burst into flame up here. I'm so dry. Just here's what I believe, and I believe this with all my heart, and I work with alcoholics every day, and I try to tell them this. The purpose of AA and these steps that seem so dumb and non-applicable to things is to very slowly do what alcohol used to do fast. It has little by little changed my perception of reality. It has little by little changed my relationship to the world around me. It has little by little made me taller, a little more self-confident, and them a little less scary. And the point is this, I got to remember this. This is a strange disease, as I talked about earlier. And you get feeling pretty good. And the tendency is for your mind to say, you shouldn't have to do this anymore. That's the same way of a diabetic saying, you don't have to take insulin anymore. You're doing fine. And the people who leave here fall by the wayside. It's not because AA doesn't work. And it's not because they're bad people. They don't realize that that's what the compensation to compensate for my left to my own devices, I will slide back. Now, I talked about the three steps tonight about for the newcomer. But I'll tell you, they're as important to the old timers as anything I know. Because your mind is doing well and you're doing fine and you've been sober a long time. And what's the purpose of all this AA crap anyway? I'll tell you what the purpose of it is. Because on my own, my life will become unmanageable. My emotions will slowly pull me away. And I've watched that happen to so many people. And it looks as though I'm standing still and everybody else is going to hell. little by little. And one day you feel bad. And my case is different. And down they go. I've watched that happen to guys in a lot of years sobriety. So to me, the first three steps of AA are as important tonight as they ever were when I lived was new. And the purpose of them is to little by little live me with some degree of freedom, strength. It's an amazing thing, you know, as I mentioned last night, because I've been sober so long and I've been active and I've been asked to speak all over the world and go places. And you think you'd really find exotic meetings in these places, but except for the accents, you hear the same old crap you hear in your local meeting. There's people with the same emotions and the same feelings. Some guy in a turban in Bali 5 weeks ago talking about just the same thing I heard the night before and or week before in Los Angeles. Emotions, feelings. And I don't think I'm getting along. I don't think drinking much, but I'm not. And all over the world, it boils down to groups of people. In every group, there's a group of people who've seem to come to AA and somehow or other been got through those steps or been pushed through the steps and they're feeling better, their perceptions are different. In every group there's a bunch of people who don't take the steps and they sharpshoot and call the people who take the steps Nazis and fascists. And in the middle are the newcomers. And both these groups fight for their soul. And surprisingly, we hold as many as we do because the arguments against AA are better than the arguments for it. You give all sorts of arguments against it. For it, you say, well, it worked. Not a really enthusiastic, right? But that's what it's about. And that's why it's so important. For alcoholics of our type, and it seems to me nobody would be in this room tonight if they weren't an alcoholic of our type. If you could still drink, you'd be out drinking. If you could stay sober comfortably, you'd be out staying sober comfortably. But when you can't do either, you're driven into meetings like this, where you're driven to take actions that change your perception of reality. The last thing I want to say, because I think about this last night I was going to sleep, about, because nobody ever knows why AA works. They know how it works. Read chapter 5. Hardly ever seen it. But why does this work this way? In the 1700s, 1600s, 1700s, in England and in America, the worst enemy people had was smallpox. Just waves of smallpox would wipe out populations. And just, nobody knew how to get rid of germs or bacteria. Think, God is punishing these people. They're all dying. Should I leave town? Should I stay in town? Should I hide in my bed? What will I do? And nobody, they just died. I have a book called Bring Out Your Dead, talking about Philadelphia. The wagons would come through and they'd say, bring out your dead. And you'd take your dead child or your dead mother and throw her out of the wagon. Nobody did. In London, a young guy named Edward Jenner was a doctor. And he tried to help these people, but he couldn't help them. And he noticed a funny phenomenon. There was one class of people who didn't get smallpox for some reason. The people around him, they were milkmaids who milked cows. And he talked to a bunch of milkmaids. Some of the milkmaids had got smallpox, some had died. But this group hadn't. Now what the hell did they have in common? They all had got something called cowpox, which was a mild infection, and they got sick and got better. And from then on, they could never get smallpox. Nobody knew why, because nobody heard it. Bacteria, germs, anything. So he did in the 1700s, he did one of the classic medical experiments of all time. He bought a little boy at an orphanage called Jimmy Phipps, 9 years old. And he took Jimmy Phipps to where the people had cowpox, and they didn't know how to change them. Disease passed along. He did the best he could. He cut a little slash in the arm and took some pus off the girl with cowpox and rubbed it in the kid's arm. He thought, maybe that'd do it. And sure enough, the kid got sick and got better. Then he took him to where they were dying of smallpox in the pest house. And he didn't use his hand. This time he used a stick. And he cut the kid's arm. And he took sticks and pus and blood and put it in the kid's arm. And the kid got sick and got better. That's the first time they knew how to get. They didn't know why it worked, but somehow, when you had cowpox, you didn't get smallpox. And there are a lot of people who would not accept it. You don't get better from a disease by getting another disease. That's crazy. That's nonsense. But some people did, and they stayed alive. In fact, the name for cow in Latin is vaccus, as you may know. And what vaccination means, injection of the cow. And about 100 and some years later, they discovered why it worked. They finally had bacteria, and they understood about germs and microscopes, and turns out that the virus of cowpox sets up a defense against smallpox and will not permit it to take over the body. And they were very glad to know it. But it had been working for 125 years before they realized it. That's what I got to think about AA somehow. Nobody knows why it works. Maybe in another 100 years after we're all dead, some doctor will come out of his laboratory and say, I found the answer at last. Taking 12 simple actions that don't make sense seems to affect the cerebral cortex in such a way that perceptions are changed. Oh, doctor, wonderful, wonderful. That won't help us. We're going to be dead. So what do we say to the new people and we say to each other? We don't care how it looks to you. Take the cowpox. Take the cowpox. Find a sponsor and take the cowpox. And if you've been sober a long time and outgrow this, go back in there and take the cowpox. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. I'm so glad that as a result of what I did, I eventually came to believe in AA. My sponsor died, another sponsor. I eventually found a God that I could try to pray to. I changed enough. And I eventually, after that, a couple years later, began to believe that God loved me, no more than you, no less than you. And little by little, I have gone to bed without praying or getting up without praying for 40 years. And I've lived comfortably with that knowledge. And I think to myself, I could have died on the streets and never guessed this would happen. The last thing I want to say, when I was 15 years old, I was marked for death in Beverly Hills, and the purpose of AA is to change your thinking. And it changed mine too much. And one day I found myself leaving my job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 32 years, I've been the managing director of the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And people said, why would I give up your big career to run this damn mission? And I could never think of a good answer. Well, for such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. Well, I'm still looking for those two guys that got me that day. Once I get them, I'll be out of their hip. I don't know. I'm going to be going to work again next Wednesday morning, and I'll have a different life than most of you. I get up by the ocean. I don't live in Skid Row. I live up by the ocean. And I get up, get my car, and drive downtown. I go through Beverly Hills. My car still wants to get off. That. No, you can't get off here. And I go downtown to where I work in the middle of park my car in the garage and walk around the building and step over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and insanity and craziness. And he just wants to say, come on, there's a better way to go. But no one could ever say to me. And I'll go to my office. We spend all day trying to find ways to, if we can just save some of these people. And I go home at night. Some of them are still there. I see you, Jimmy. Go home, go to bed, or go to a meeting. And thank God that there's some hope for me. Now, you might think, if God loves everybody, why is this alcoholic dying on the street and I'm walking feeling good? And it's just this simple. He will not take the cowpox. He will not. That's the only difference. He will not take the actions. No, don't do that crap. And I just know how you feel, pal, because I said the same thing better than you ever said. So we want to remember doing it. A is for us to live with that somberly, not shaking our fists, with hope and comfort. And sometimes we have bad days, because no matter how hard you work your program, you never rise above human being. And there are some days in every life that by 10 o'clock you just know there's no hope for this day. This day is a gone goose. Everybody's gone crazy, for Christ's sake. So you just keep your mouth shut and think to yourself, come on, midnight. Come on, midnight. Let's get this thing out of the way. But walk with some degree of dignity, some degree of hope, some degree of peace. And when that day comes, it's worth everything it took. God bless you.